Max, Danny, Sandra, thank you so much for being here tonight. Marion, you're like my mother, but don't think that you're going to clap me on the head with a spoon. Never again. And Digby, I will thank you later. Well, welcome everybody. What an absolute joy and privilege it is for me to be giving my inaugural here at UCT during the centenary celebration of our faculty. And tonight I want to talk to you about what is my passion, understanding the enemy, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. This is the tubercle bacillus, this rod-shaped organism over here, discovered by the great Robert Koch in 1882. And I call it the enemy by virtue of what the TB bacillus has done to humanity. Estimated to infect 1 in 3 people on this planet, 1.5 million deaths of TB, 9 million new cases of TB each year. A sobering way to think about what we're up against is a death of TB every 20 seconds. So for the hour that we're here tonight, about 200 people will die of tuberculosis. And in thinking about how to frame tonight's talk, I came upon this quote by Sun Tzu, the Chinese military general, strategist, and philosopher from ancient China. Invincibility lies in the defense, the possibility of victory in the attack. And if Sun Tzu had known about the tubercle bacillus, he would understand how relevant this is. I want to talk about the invincibility of this pathogen, which lies in the extraordinary defense mechanisms that it is able to harness against what we can throw at it. So the incidence of tuberculosis, incidence is cases per 100,000 of the population. The dark green represent the countries of highest incidence. The most populous nations on earth, China and India, have the highest burden of TB. But when you divide by the population size, you see the incidence is sitting in our country and in our neighboring countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, the problem here is the very high prevalence of HIV co-infection together with TB. And HIV prevalence in TB cases in South Africa and neighboring countries is about 50% today. There are drugs for the treatment of TB. It is a curable disease with short-course chemotherapy, which paradoxically takes 6 months. For me as a basic scientist, short-course and 6 months don't make sense. But in fact, those drugs work against drug-susceptible TB, but not against drug-resistant TB. And as if the problem of tuberculosis is not bad enough, we're now dealing with a global emergency of drug-resistant TB growing as we speak. The figures are alarming. About 500,000 cases of MDR TB, multi-drug-resistant TB, resistant to the first two-line drugs, isoniazid and rifampicin, has moved towards extensively drug-resistant TB, recognized in 2006 by the WHO as a big problem, a global threat, and in fact made real by the very, very tragic outbreak of XDR-TB in KwaZulu-Natal in Tugela Ferry, in a particularly high prevalence HIV area and associated with very high mortality. And in fact, this figure I think is really very, very telling, because in the 5 years since the Tugela Ferry outbreak, there are more than 90 countries around the world that have recorded at least one case of XDR-TB. And the TB lexicon continues to grow. We are now in the age of TDR-TB or XXDR-TB, totally drug-resistant tuberculosis. The WHO has not defined this, but I think the name is telling. There are no chemotherapeutic options for this form of tuberculosis. And drug-resistant TB threatens the ability to deal with this disease in the individual patient and in the context of a treatment program. I want to share with you tonight my passion for working on tuberculosis and tell you my story of how I got interested in this field and illustrate it with some vignettes that show the kind of science that I've been doing together with this incredible group of people who've worked with me over the past 18 years. And in fact, my entry to the TB field was somewhat inauspicious. I was a finalist, I believe the first and only finalist, in the first competition for the Wellcome Trust International Research Fellowship in South Africa. I went to London 7 months pregnant with Natalie, and I was quite confident that I would just get the grant, but I didn't. And to the youngsters out there, I see a lot of grey hairs. Are there any students out there tonight? I hope there's some students out there. My message is don't be discouraged by a failed grant application. I turned around and I asked, what had I done wrong? In fact, I had the wrong pedigree. I was just a simple chemist. I had no clinical understanding of TB as disease, and actually my proposal was naive. And so I sat back and I thought I needed to improve it. And then I got lucky. I got lucky in the form of the Glaxo Welcome Action TB Initiative. And Paul and Nilda, it's wonderful to see you here from Stellenbosch. So many of us are beneficiaries of that incredible initiative that brought funding to South Africa. And I say that today in South Africa, we are dealing with arguably the best TB research community in the world. And so many of us are a product of that. And I'll show you why as I tell the stories of the people, how many people came in and have remained in that field. But in fact, it was when TB struck home that I really started to think about why I wanted to work on this disease. This is my family. My mom and dad, they're sitting in the front row, and my two daughters, Dani and Natalie. And this picture is taken 2 years after my mom nearly died of tuberculosis. She was, I suppose, the wrong phenotype, being a middle-class family in the northern suburbs of Johannesburg. And it took a while for her to be diagnosed. But when she was diagnosed, it was drug-susceptible TB, and she was cured. But in fact, TB striking home thrust us into the public health sector and the amazing doctors at Sizwe Tropical Hospital in Sandringham, who treated her. We experienced the difficulties of diagnostic delay, of drug susceptibility testing, how tough it was to sit and wait to hear about the drug susceptibility. And of course, the close contacts. This picture typifies our family. My kids and my sister's kids were tiny at the time, and they sat on top of my mom all the time. And then we had to ask the question how to deal with close contacts. And of course was the issue of stigma. And this hit my mom particularly badly. And I talked to her yesterday and I said, do you mind me talking about this? And she said, 15 years ago, I wouldn't have liked you to talk about it, but I'm okay now. Not to be outdone, my dad got TB 10 years later. So, but by the time he got TB, in fact, you know, we were old hat at dealing with this disease, and he took the medication, and, you know, they're here today, they're TB survivors, and they helped me to think about this disease. I was a basic scientist, after all, with no clinical experience, and it forced me to think about the realities of what I was working on. I'd always kept this healthy distance between myself and what I worked on, but no more. And in fact, that sounds all very well and good. In fact, why I wanted to work on TB is this is just a fantastic, incredible, exciting field to work in. And it's the science which has inspired me. And this thinking about how to present my story, this picture is really a stunning depiction of a macrophage, for the non-scientists in the audience from Seapoint, a macrophage, and there are probably some scientists from Seapoint too. The macrophage is a cell of the immune system that invades bacteria. A bacteria go into them, and it engulfs them and kills them. But the TB bacillus getting engulfed by this bacterium belongs to an elite group of organisms that chooses to live in this environment. So therein lies a story. It's choosing to live in a particularly hostile environment. So implicit in that is that this bug has got incredible ways of adapting to the conditions that it encounters where it finds itself in a macrophage inside a human host. And here are the questions that framed my thinking as a scientist. How does this adaptation occur? Greg says, I've adapted. I've learned from the tubercle bacillus, Greg. How does M. tuberculosis maintain the integrity of its DNA? I was very interested in DNA metabolism. The macrophage throws hostile chemicals at the bacillus, damaging the DNA. How does the DNA remain intact over those 30 years between a primary infection and reactivation disease? And the counterside to that is how does drug resistance evolve? Because we already knew that drug resistance was the flip side of genetic variation. It results from evolution of the bacterium towards drug resistance. So I want to tell you some stories, and our approach here is, for me as a simple scientist, the whole bacterium is far too complex to think about. So we've deconstructed it and taken apart and looked at specific metabolic pathways, kind of looks like the London Underground map. This is a map of the pyrimidine biosynthesis pathway of M. tuberculosis. Study enzymes, put them together in pathways, and then put the pathways together inside the bacterium to get a better idea of how the bug sits inside the human host. So we've investigated aspects of physiology and metabolism of relevance to the questions that I've just described. And it makes sense to start with DNA metabolism because this, for me, is where it began. And I introduced the first of the Glaxo Welcome Action TB postdocs, Bhavna Gordon, who to this day remains in the Wits lab that I left behind. And I recognized that as a chemist, I knew nothing about genetics and microbiology. And so I hired people who did know what I didn't know. And Bhavna came in and we started developing tools for making gene knockouts. In essence, you've got a chromosome. The bacterium has 4,000 genes on the chromosome. We needed to know how to surgically excise individual genes. And Bhavna set up the methods for doing this. In fact, one of the very first papers we published in this field was one of the very first mutants in any mycobacterial species ever made. And this was to become the first of many, many more, many hundreds more over the years. And our approach was not just to do the genetics and biochemistry, but to put it together with biochemical analysis. So Peter Huberts and I, and those are the days where I did wear a lab coat and was working in the lab, we made the protein that Bhavna had made the gene knockout of, and here was to become the first of a recurring theme in my lab, which was that mycobacterium does things differently. And the stuff you read in the textbook about E. coli model systems don't work in mycobacterium. We discovered, for instance, that this particular enzyme, which is involved in replication and repair of DNA, is critically and interestingly hypersensitive to inhibition by chain-terminating nucleotides. The HIV people in the audience will recognize these as the very first antiretroviral drugs. And so I started questioning whether antiretrovirals could in fact double up as anti-tubercular drugs. The reality is they can't because these molecules don't get into the TB bacillus, but the message is clear. Don't just trust what you've learned from other organisms. You need to actually study the organism of interest. And there will always be something new and interesting. And this notion was to repeat itself multiple times. So in the early 90s, we'd set the stage for then being ready to ride the next wave. And the next wave in TB research was to move into the post-genome era. And this is the Stuart Cole, an absolute giant in the tuberculosis field, who became a great friend and colleague and an inspiration to me. Stuart built the genome sequencing project for M. tuberculosis. This is one of the first whole organisms to have its genome sequenced and one of the first bacteria. And the policy of the Wellcome Trust that had funded the genome sequencing project was to put the data onto the web every single night. Anybody in the world could access the data. And me sitting in a small office in downtown Bromfontein with a dial-up modem sat and annotated the genome of M. tuberculosis. And we published, Sue Anderson and I, published what I believe is the first post-genome paper in the TB field. And what we did is actually ask, having the blueprint of the tubercle bacillus, what does its DNA repair repertoire look like? We'd expected it to be very enriched because it's living in a hostile environment. In fact, it was the opposite. We discovered very interestingly that one of the main and most highly conserved DNA repair pathways conserved throughout nature, MTBs kicked out. So there was a paradox there, and it became a very highly cited paper because this was an interesting discovery. But more than that discovery, this paper created the foundation and the blueprint upon which all of our later work was based. And one of the studies was that we started questioning and asking the question as to whether M. tuberculosis could mount a deliberate orchestrated response to DNA damage. And the idea here was borrowed from other fields. Bacteria sustains DNA damage, the chromosome takes a hit, and then there's an orchestrated set of events whereby this protein gets degraded, falls off the DNA, and a whole bunch of other proteins get made. It's called an SOS response because it simply is a do-or-die response. If the bacteria are able to mount this response, they can avert death. And so Steve Durbach, the next Action TB person to join my lab, an absolutely brilliant, very creative scientist, lost to South Africa. He's an artist in Sydney today, lost to science as well. Steve did some of the functional experiments which actually demonstrated that the key pieces of the system were intact in M. tuberculosis. So the stage was set for the next person to join my lab. The TB people in this audience will know her well. She has become a very famous scientist. She is Helena Boshoff. I'm hugely privileged to have been her PhD supervisor. She went to the NIH where she works together with Cliff Barry. And Helena did a really smart experiment that gave me my first real eureka moment as a scientist. She, in fact, was working on something completely different. She was working on pyrazinamide mechanism of action. But the message to bright young scientists is keep a few balls in the air. And Helena and Steve were talking, and she decided to do the following experiment. She asked whether, if we deliberately damage the DNA by giving a mycobacterium a shot of UV, give it a shot of UV irradiation, could mutations be induced in that bacterium? Could part of that SOS response be the bacterium fighting back to become drug resistant? And the answer was an absolute yes. We took this relative of MTB, which is a non-pathogenic bacterium, or MTB itself, shot them with UV irradiation, and then saw this burst of mutations that were resistant to one of the frontline TB drugs, rifampicin. So here's an example of subversion by turning stress to an advantage. DNA damage gets sensed by the bacterium, and it fights back and it becomes resistant to antibiotics. So we sensed we were onto something very interesting here. Helena was on her way to the States as a postdoc, and Cliff Barry, whose lab she worked in, was generous enough to give us access to all of his technology, including microarrays. And Helena was able to make the next big discovery, which is although the phenomenon of fighting back by making mutants was common with other bacteria, the players were very different. And we discovered, in fact, what is a now known and published widely in the field as a new system. It is an entirely novel mechanism of induced mutation to drug resistance. Helena went on and did experiments in animal models of TB and showed that, in fact, this protein called DNA E2 is necessary for MTB to be fully virulent, and went on in some tour de force experiments that only Helena Boshoff could do to show that, in fact, in mice that were treated with rifampicin in a way that a non-adherent TB patient would be, in other words, taking their drugs not as regularly as they should be, that gene was implicated in the evolution of drug resistance. And so this was a big paper. It was published in Cell, which is one of the top journals in the world, very proud to be associated with this study. And the message out of this study is that out of mycobacteria comes something new and something potentially important. And the story didn't end there. And Digby, who's privileged to have as part of the podium party tonight, took the story to another level. Being a smart sleuth, and in fact another lesson from Digby's career, is to read widely, reads voraciously outside of his own field. And that's the sign of a great scientist, I believe. Made an interesting association, which was linked with work from other fields. And that is, whenever you find DNA E2, you find these other two proteins, which are real schleppers, basically. They schlep along for the ride with DNA E2. Where you find DNA E2, you find these other two guys. So Digby said, well, are they all part of the same pathway? And he did Helena's experiment where he asked, does UV irradiation induce mutations? And if you knock out any of these three genes, you get the same effect. So in fact, all three genes are part of the pathway, and went on to show they act in the same pathway, and then did a really beautiful experiment that built on the power of the genetic tools that we had meticulously been building as a lab. He looked at this DNA E2 protein, and for this is really for the biochemists who I think will appreciate this most, looked at the active site of the DNA E2 protein. Now, that's really the business end of the molecule. And this protein, by the way, sits on DNA, and it's like a hand. It's like a clamp that latches onto the DNA. And created and identified that there were certain amino acids at the active site that would be necessary for catalysis. Knocked them out by transferring point mutations onto the chromosome, and basically showed that you can take two mutations into Mycobacterium smegmatis and completely kill this induced mutagenesis phenotype. And this is a study I'm very proud of. It was part of a project together with Dudu Ndwandwe, our PhD student who will be finishing a PhD at WITS this year, Edith and Garth, published in PNAS a short while ago, and it's a story, again, a nice homegrown story of telling you, really, my message here is the systematic way in which we've tried to dissect apart pathways that are implicated in the evolution of drug resistance. I want to shift gear now and talk about the other question, which is how does MTB actually adapt to the environment that it encounters? And the pathologists amongst you will know that when TB is sitting in the lung of an infected patient, it's sitting in a very hostile, nutrient-deprived situation. There's not a whole lot of oxygen around, and there's not a whole lot of carbon source around in the granuloma of a lung of a TB patient. And so the question we were interested in is, how does TB actually adapt to these hostile conditions of starvation? And one of the stories that we elaborated was to understand how TB breathes. It's an aerobic bacterium, and it means it needs to make energy, to make ATP, it needs oxygen. So So it's an aerobic bug, and all living organisms actually use a very highly conserved mechanism to make energy. It involves electrons flowing onto oxygen, resulting in the production of ATP. We discovered that MTB has actually got a split in this pathway. There are two routes that the electrons can flow. They can flow that way or that way. And we figured that this would allow the bug to adapt the flow of electrons to the availability of oxygen. And so we set about to answer the question of how and why and if this pathway allows the bug to adapt to oxygen availability. And here's another really important player in my lab, Bhavesh Khanna, who has really taken over the lab I left behind at WITS. And Bhavesh said, let's kill the function of this pathway and see what happens to the bugs. This top pathway, we thought, would allow the bacterium to scavenge low amounts of oxygen. And lo and behold, when he made a mutant that in which this pathway was blocked, and he took these bacteria and he cultivated them in the presence of very limiting amounts of oxygen, you can see that compared to the parent strain, which kind of grows well, this is a measure of growth, this mutant doesn't do so well. So there was functional demonstration of its role. And then Dimonako Matsotso, a PhD student of ours from Lesotho, came in and said, well, let's do it the other way around. And we were actually quite surprised that she was able to inactivate this part of the pathway because there was work coming from other people suggesting that actually this was going to be a weak link in the bacillus, that you can't block this pathway. In fact, she got mutants and they were alive. But in fact, let me just introduce you to the agar plate. We do very simple microbiology. We're looking at colonies of bacteria growing up on an agar plate. The normal strain, where both of these pathways are active, nice fat colonies after about a week or so. The mutant growing really, really poorly, quite sick. And so the question is, the fact that mutant is alive, how is it alive? And Dimonako did a key experiment where she measured the level of this protein having knocked that one out. And she saw it went up enormously. And so the message here, without even needing to understand the science underlying it, is you close one door, another opens. And this is a subversion strategy. The bug has bypass mechanisms which we need to understand if we want to find better ways to eradicate it. So there's a good example of a bypass mechanism. In fact, our work on the electron transport chain was the first that opened up a field that has become an extraordinarily active field, the respiratory chain of M. tuberculosis, simply because it is rich with TB drug targets. Those of you who watched the news and heard about this trial that was done by Andreas Diakon from Stellenbosch and Rod Dawson from the UCT Lung Institute and the TB Alliance, this new drug that has the potential for treatment shortening, it acts here, okay? It acts immediately next door to the enzymes I've just told you about. This is the ATP synthase inhibitor. Helena Boshoff and Harvey Rubin simultaneously identified the target of phenothiazines. The clinicians will know these as antipsychotic drugs. They're actually used for the treatment of MDR-TB in certain countries as well. And so we're sitting in the middle of two very important drug targets, and here is the case in which the bacterium can sense and adapt. And so over the years, we published quite a lot of papers in this area. And moreover, the adaptation of the system is beyond just using oxygen as a way of breathing. Actually, TB can hold its breath. If there's no oxygen around, TB can survive on nitrate. So it's quite extraordinary. And we've discovered and analyzed the function of the enzyme that enables TB to hold its breath. And this becomes a really important feature about the ability of the tubercle bacillus to persist in lesions in which oxygen is extremely limiting, and might underlie this ability or the great difficulty that we have in killing the TB bacillus using tools and using drugs that target actively growing aerobic organisms. So that was quite a nice story. We then moved into another area of starvation, which is to do with carbon starvation. So I've talked about oxygen, but bugs need food to grow. And working together with Harvey Rubin and then with Cliff Berry and Gila Kaplan, who have been tremendous international collaborators who've been part of my life for the last 15 years, we studied a system known as the astringent response system, which is a really cute way that bacteria are able to put the brakes on when they don't have any amino acids around. And Harvey had studied the astringent response protein, and contacted us And through the NIH, we got funding to do the genetics, and we were able to show that, in fact, if we kill the function of the stringent response, and we took these bacteria, these TB bugs, and put them in a test tube with no amino acids and left them for a couple of months. This goes out for 3 or 4 months. Everything in TB research is slow, by the way. The bug is like really slow. So it's, I mean, it's a paradox that I work on this, actually. It tests my patients. There's the wild-type MTB. It dies slowly, but you lose the ability to respond and put on the brakes. You fail to persist. This is in a test tube. This is in a mouse lung. TB infects mice, grows, and persists. This mutant that lacks the stringent response regulator allowed us to identify this protein as one of the very first persistence factors identified in TB. And these two stories about oxygen and carbon starvation take me to the next big story from my lab, which was a labor of love that we worked on for about 10 years, and I certainly hope Katrina Downing is here, because she is one of the heroes of the piece. And I want to introduce you to the concept of dormancy. What is a dormant bacterium? There are certain bacteria that, when upon prolonged starvation, go to sleep. Okay? You take them and you try to put them on an agar plate. They don't grow. Okay? They're asleep, but they're not dead. And in fact, there was a lot of work going on in other fields. Again, we borrow from other fields. Other fields had shown that there was a protein that a certain bacterium called Micrococcus, unlike Mycobacterium, completely unrelated, produces a protein that is its wake-up call. So you can take dormant Micrococcus, give it this protein, and it wakes up. So there's this phenomenon of dormancy and resuscitation as a microbiological phenomenon. And of course, TB at a clinical level, we know that an individual becomes infected. Most people control that infection, but we can get reactivation or post-primary disease decades later. So there's a clinical phenomenon of latent or subclinical infection followed by reactivation. The question is, could these two phenomena be related to one another? And so we set about to ask this question. And the way we did it is to recognize that this resuscitation-promoting factor, I'll call it RPF, discovered in this lowly bug called Micrococcus of no clinical relevance whatsoever, has five cousins sitting in TB. It's like a nice big Jewish family, right? There's five cousins sitting in TB. Okay, five is a headache. One is okay. Five is a headache. But not to be deterred, we set about to study the function of the five resuscitation-promoting factors. I call it a heroic effort because this is what one of the reviewers of our paper called it. Here are the heroes. Katrina, Bhavna, and Bhavesh. And the story goes as follows. Bhavna was on maternity leave, and so Katrina started the project. Katrina went on maternity leave, Bhavna took over the project. Bhavesh said, hell with this, I'm going to finish the project. And this is a period of time in my lab in Joburg in which we were producing more babies than publications. And it was really a source of great concern to me. But in any event, the mother of two kids, right? Okay, in any event, I just wanted papers. But there were lots of babies coming. But this trio took wild-type M tuberculosis and one at a time systematically deleted these genes out of the TB genome. Each arrow here is 6 months' worth of work. Okay, this is years' worth of work. And eventually we discovered MTB can live without any of these resuscitation-promoting factors. But it's got a really interesting phenotype. And if you take one thing away from tonight's lecture, I want you to remember this picture. Here's how the story goes. Arseniy Kaprelyants in Moscow had developed a model that if you take TB, shake it in a sealed flask with very little oxygen, it eats all the food that is available in the culture medium, so it goes into starvation mode, and you continue shaking it for 3.5 months. Open the tube, put the TB bacillus onto a plate, onto an agar plate, nothing. They look dead, right? Put them into a liquid medium, go away a couple of weeks later, and come back. There they are again. When I say that we are up against a formidable pathogen, this is what I'm talking about. These dormant bacilli can spontaneously resuscitate. Wild-type MTB can do it, but here, the mutants that we generated were resuscitation defective. They were unable to resuscitate. Bhavesh was able to show on agar plates that the resuscitation defect was associated with a culturability defect. They don't form colonies well. So in fact, we finally had a tool that would enable us to ask, is there clinical relevance? And in fact, the clinical relevance was not tested by us. It was our sharing of the strain that we produced that has no RPFs that enabled Galia Mokhamalova, working in Leicester, of all places, on TB in Leicester in the UK, asked the question as to whether if one took sputum of a TB patient and looked at the bacteria in TB patient sputum and then fed those bacteria a diet that contains these resuscitation promoting factors or a control that doesn't, is there a difference? And all I want you to look at is the y-axis. It's this arbitrary thing called resuscitation index. The bugs fed a diet containing RPFs are the open bars, the ones from our strain, closed bars. There is a difference, and that difference is significant. Bottom line is that there is evidence from this experiment that in the bacteria in sputum of a TB patient, there are RPF-responsive bacteria, dormant bacteria. They went on to show a putative association of that type of bacillus with slow response to therapy. One of course, the big problems with TB is that we have to treat for so long. We know if you stop the current drugs after 2 months, you will get relapse. And so it's very intriguing to think that there is an association of the slow death with this incredible property of the bacillus. So let me finish with two very quick stories, and again, Digby features here. We've worked a lot on vitamins and cofactors, and I call this a story of, I can't read from here, metabolic flexibility and astute observation. TB is a bacillus that can make all vitamins and cofactors. And we were working on this enzyme. Digby was working on this in his PhD. It's involved in nucleotide metabolism. Nucleotides are the building blocks of DNA. And he discovered that one of these enzymes that makes the building blocks of DNA needs a vitamin B12 shot in order to work. And so, okay, we moved on. And then we were joined by Susanna Savi, who I also hope is here, a brilliant PhD student who came to work as a postdoc with Frank Brombacher after finishing up with us at WITS. And what Susanna worked on is another completely different vitamin B12-dependent enzyme. And this is a system which allows the bug to do another trick, and that is to detoxify a nasty molecule called propionate that is produced as a byproduct of its diet. A lot of what we eat gives us bad byproducts. The TB bacillus lives on fat. Listen to this for a diet. Fat, cholesterol, and amino acids, branched chain amino acids. This is what this bug eats for a living. Propionate gets made. John McKinney and the beauty of science, is that different people come in simultaneously from different angles and converge on the same thing. John was coming in from studying one pathway for propionate detoxification, and he had basically shown that if you kill that pathway and you put these bugs in propionate, they don't grow. What Susanna did is she showed that if you add B12, you give the bugs a B12 shot, by putting vitamin B12 in the culture medium, they grow. Again, the second story of a bypass mechanism. So as long as the bugs can see vitamin B12, you can bypass propionate toxicity by giving the bug another way of dealing with a toxic problem. So you can, I hope, understand why I've called my talk Survival and Subversion Strategies. This is a highly subversive organism, okay? The story didn't end there. Again, comes back to Digby and his astute observation. He was able to discover and show the mechanism of how enteroviruses of a particular clinical strain that caused an outbreak of TB about 20 years ago in the US, a very highly publicized outbreak in a factory. This bug, for some reason, is highly sensitive to vitamin B12. And the story will be his to tell when he gives his inaugural at some point in the future. But a totally UCT-based project that he has done together with Gopinath Krishnamurti, a stunning postdoc who has graced South Africa from New Delhi and works with us in the Institute. Those from the Institute know Gopi. He works day and night. He's my favorite guy. I love him. Okay. Gopi is just spectacular. Gopi has identified the way in which TB takes up vitamin B12. The biochemist and chemist amongst you will appreciate this. Vitamin B12 is one of nature's most elegant molecules. It's a big beast of a molecule, and it's complex. We think of the TB bacillus as this impenetrable organism, and yet B12 gets in. And he found the transporter, and he and Digby will be going to France in 2 weeks' time to present this at two major international meetings. So I want to close by coming home now to UCT, which is where I was educated. And the story is about drug discovery now. And the idea of coming to UCT was inspired by not just wanting to work with the greatest TB scientists in the world in the Western Cape and coming to what I know is the best institute of its kind in the world, the IIDMM, but it was to be next to this man, this great man, Kelly Chivani, who is the head of the H3D Drug Discovery Center in the chemistry department, the department where I grew up. And Kelly is a chemist, and I'm today a biologist. And we feel that chemistry and biology together is what you need for TB drug discovery, and we want to do it here on South African soil. And Rich Gordon and Glordina Lutz are here, and they have been tremendous supporters of this homegrown TB drug discovery initiative called SATRI, South African TB Research and Innovation Initiative, which I am very, very proud to be part of. And the background here is that there is an urgent need for new TB drugs that are treatment-shortening and have novel mechanisms of action. This is a bullseye view of where we stand today. I'm humbled. 10 years ago, there were no drugs in clinical development. Today, there are 10 drugs in clinical development. It's not enough. Drugs can and will fail in clinical development without wanting to sign negative. We cannot afford to be caught short again after 4 decades of neglect in this field. We have to keep replenishing this pipeline, and that's what we're trying to do here. And this leads me to my last paper, published just 3 weeks ago, and arguably the paper that I'm most proud of. It is the story of Garth Abrams, a UCT graduate trained by Val Abrett in molecular and cell biology up the hill. He went to Germany, he came to me at WITS. He's now part of the UCT group, but he's working again with Helena Boshoff at the NIH. Those of you who are going to come to the Wolfson Pavilion, to the Wolfson Colloquium, I will speak on this story at the Wolfson Colloquium. Essentially, what we've done is we've put the pieces together and taken our genetic tools and created ways, new ways of discovering TB drugs. A method called target-based whole cell screening, led by Garth, and this is the trio here in our lab at UCT, who are using this kind of methodology to fuel the TB drug development pipeline. I feel absolutely, as a South African, we are sitting in a lower middle income country that has one of the worst TB problems in the world. It is up to us to shoulder our responsibility in trying to tackle this. I can do it as a scientist. There are public health specialists out there. And I say to you, science is necessary but not sufficient. Okay? We can deliver better tools. We need better ways of applying those tools. And so I want to leave you with this quote, also from Sun Tzu from The Art of War. Know your enemy and know yourself, and you can fight 100 battles without disaster. I've chosen to know the enemy. Our colleagues in the IIDMN and elsewhere who are doing spectacular work on the host immune responses to TB are learning about knowing yourself. And I feel that together we are going to make a difference. I'm privileged to be part of what I believe is really the most vibrant TB research community in the world. And so let me just close with thanks. This is the gallery of stars. This is not my inaugural. This is about the people who have graced my lab over the years, and they are spectacular. At the NHLS, I was called the Rottweiler. And so I don't know what they call me at the IIDMM. Probably something quite similar. Bottom line, I'm tough and demanding, and these people are survivors of my lab. And they're all just incredible people. So I've applied Darwinian selection to pick these people. This is my lab at WITS in the NHLS, which will always remain such a special place for me. And this is us. This is this fantastic group who shared in the vision of wanting to come to UCT to work in this incredible place, close to our colleagues at Stellenbosch, and in an institute that unashamedly wants to work for Africa in Africa. This is the part where I have to try not to cry. These are the most important people in my life. My mom and dad, my sister, thanks for coming from Joburg. I would never have been able to give this without you. Lynette and I have always felt that we won the parent lottery. And I think I won the children's lottery. We have just got, we're such a tight-knit family. We just all love each other. And Mom and Dad, you just never said no to anything I wanted to do. And you backed me through the good times and the bad, and I miss you a lot. But Joburg is not that far away. Tom Modrow and Steve Benkovic taught me how to be a scientist. They taught me the value of education. They didn't teach me that I was going to be trained to be anything. They taught me to want to learn. and how to think as a scientist. And I will always remember that. And the chemistry department of UCT and Luigi, thank you for being here. You are one of my heroes. And what can I say? This spectacular trio of ladies in our deanery, each of you knows what you mean to me. It's been an interesting ride for me here in the last 18 months. And Marion, Sue, and Karen, we are so privileged to have people of your caliber in the faculty. People, you know, you've had my back since I was here. And that has meant an enormous amount to me. Greg, thank you for bringing me here. Robert, you made it possible. Annalise, more than being my colleague, you're my friend. And thank you for that. And these are the members of the IIDMM's Executive Committee and Management Committee. You know who you are. Digby is just, I have one word for him. He's just a mensch. He's a scientist. And thank you and Emma for coming to join in this fantastic journey together with me. Paul and Bhavesh, and the unsung heroes, Andrew Wien. You know, I never had an assistant before I came to the Institute. What would I do without an assistant today? Andrew Wien, Rion, Berenice, Heather, Stephen, and Kathy. These are the people who don't stand up to give the talks, but they are the ones who make our lives as scientists what they are today. And thank you for your attention. Wow.